Window number 2, February 12th, 2024. Prelude. I don't underline text when I read. It takes too much time. I fold back the top corner of pages that have material of a special interest to me, hoping I'll remember why when I come back to them. I compile the list below retrospectively by going back over the various pages I had marked in this way, and then typing out the passage that I assume I wanted to remember. Then, for efficiency's sake, I whittled that list down to my top 14 for each book, mostly to highlight my readerly predilections in each case, time for Morton, education for McLuhan. Those long-term obsessions of mine mingling with theirs, as is the case with every reader who writes about what they read. I insert it here so you can listen to some snippets of their voices before mine finally takes over. These are the passages from Hyperobjects, Philosophy and Ecology After the End of the World. Hyperobjects are entities that become visible through post-Humean statistical causality, a causality that is actually better for realism than simply positing the existence of glass spheres on which the fixed stars rotate. Global warming denial is also a denial of what causality is after Hume and Kant, namely a feature of phenomena rather than things in themselves. It's on page 16. In a sense, we can expect human egos to be pockmarked with the traces of hyperobjects. It's on page 51. The undulating fronds of space and time float in front of objects. It's on page 63. This wake of causality would appear to flow backward into the present. It's on page 67. Objects do not occur in time and space, but rather emit space-time. It's on page 90. Appearance is the past, essence is the future. It's on page 91. What is called nowness in Buddhist contemplative theory is not a point or even a bubble, no matter how wide, but a fluid, uncanny washing back and forth like a current and an undertow. It's on page 93. Futurality is reinscribed into the present, ending the metaphysics of presence, not through some neat philosophical footwork, but because the very large finitude of hyperobjects forces humans to coexist with a strange future, a future without us. Page 94. What is left if we aren't in the world? Intimacy. We have lost the world, but gained a soul. The entities that coexist with us obtrude on our awareness with greater and greater urgency. Three cheers for the so-called end of the world, then, since this moment is the beginning of history, the end of the human dream that reality is significant for them alone. We now have the prospect of forging new alliances between humans and non-humans alike, now that we have stepped out of the cocoon of world. That's page 108. This is a momentous era at which we achieve what has sometimes been called ecological awareness. Ecological awareness is a detailed and increasing sense, in science and outside of it, of the innumerable interrelationships among life forms and between life and non-life. On page 128. Thus, the time of hyperobjects is a time of sincerity, a time in which it is impossible to achieve a final distance toward the world. It's page 130. The proximity of an alien presence that is also our innermost essence is very much its structure of feeling. That's page 139. What is doom? Doom can mean fate, destiny, and in a stronger sense, death. Finally, doom means justice, a figure that Derrida calls synonymous with deconstruction, in that it is irreducibly futural. Doesn't this rich range of meaning suggest something about the hyperobject? the hyperobject is indeed the bringer of fate, destiny, and death. This destiny comes from beyond the human world and pronounces or decrees the end of the world. It's on pages 147 and 148. Large complex systems require causality theories that are not deterministic. The oppressive drive to repeat the epistemological thrills and spills of the correlationist era by returning to Humean skepticism is itself a symptom that the non-humans are already here. It's on page 177. These are the quotes from Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man. We are no more prepared to encounter radio and TV in our literate milieu than the native of Ghana is able to cope with the literacy that takes him out of his collective tribe and beaches him in individual isolation. It's on page 31. The giving to man of an eye for an ear by phonetic literacy is, socially and politically, probably the most radical explosion that can occur in any social structure. Page 58. The new media and technologies by which we amplify and extend ourselves constitute huge collective surgery carried out on the social body with complete disregard for antiseptics. Page 70. I'm curious to know what would happen if art were suddenly seen for what it is, namely, exact information of how to rearrange one's psyche in order to anticipate the next blow from our own extended faculties. Page 71. Language extends and amplifies man, but it also divides his faculties. Page 83. Electricity points the way to an extension of the process of consciousness itself on a world scale and without any verbalization whatever. Such a state of collective awareness may have been the pre-verbal condition of man. Page 83. The Greek myth about the alphabet was that Cadmus, reputedly the king who introduced the phonetic letters into Greece, sowed dragon's teeth, and they sprang up armed men. Letters are not only like teeth visually, but their power to put teeth into the business of empire building is manifest in our Western history. Page 85. It can be argued then that the phonetic alphabet alone is the technology that has the means of creating civilized man, the separate individuals equal before a written code of law. Separateness of the individual, continuity of space and time, and uniformity of codes are the prime marks of literate and civilized societies. Pages 86 and 87. By imposing unvisualizable relationships that are the result of instant speed, electric technology dethrones the visual sense and restores us to the dominion of synesthesia and the close inter-involvement of the other senses. Page 108. Such has always been the case, most notoriously in government censorship of the press and the movies. Although the medium is the message, the controls go beyond programming. The restraints are always directed to the content, which is always another medium. Page 266. The only medium for which our education now offers some civil defense is the print medium. The educational establishment, founded on print, does not yet admit any other responsibilities. Page 267. A cool medium, whether the spoken word or the manuscript or TV, leaves much more for the listener or user to do than a hot medium. If the medium is of high definition, participation is low. If the medium is of low intensity, the participation is high. Page 278. In education, the conventional division of the curriculum into subjects is already as outdated as the medieval trivium and Quadrivium of the Renaissance. Page 301. Our education has long ago acquired the fragmentary and piecemeal character of mechanism. It is now under increasing pressure to acquire the depth and interrelation that are indispensable in the all-at-once world of electric organization. Paradoxically, automation makes liberal education mandatory. Page 310. Window number 3, February 2nd, 2024. Prelude. This is the first chunk of stuff I wrote for this essay while I was reading the opening sections of the books, trying to get my bearings with their respective projects, beginning to feel connections forming between them, sounding more like a review might. I wrote a lot of multi-book reviews for a small magazine early in my career, a genre still one of my favorites that demands focus and concision. Hyperobjects, Philosophy and Ecology After the End of the World, both as a book and as a concept, is Timothy Morton's attempt to reconfigure our relationship with our world once we acknowledge that that world has now ended, and we are displaced permanently from any semblance of a position of privilege vis-a-vis all the other objects with whom we shared spaces and times in what it once was. He proffers a litany of approach avoidances early on, as if one of the best ways to understand this new disorder of things is not top-down or bottom-up conceptually, that delusional remnant of Western philosophy now in tatters, but inside out and outside in, materially, the objectness of the object-oriented ontology that Morton both endorses and elaborates via his work. Global warming, a term he prefers over the much more antiseptically de-anthropomorphized climate change, ends up being his chief concern, the raison d'etre of the book in a way, a kind of looming presence-absence haunting his thinking as it haunts ours. But his inventory ranges spatially from quantum clouds of subatomic particles to the furthest astronomical reaches of the cosmos, both of whose secrets have been partially peeled back during his lifetime. From the sheen of radioactive afterglow sprinkled over the Earth's surface to the specter of nuclear annihilation those little clicks on a Geiger counter force us to live with endemically. And temporally, from the tiniest tick of time, the present that disappears even before it evanesces, that mysterious, irregular metronome that defines what life is and means for us in this universe, to the lifespan of that universe, Big Bang to whimper, its intrinsic futurality washing over us repeatedly like waves on a beach, rather than emerging unblemished from a frittered away past, a radical reordering of the presumed directionality of time. Both of these, space and time, blend into one another until neither is quite there any longer, a sort of eternal, tactile present that is no longer present to us in any recognizable respect, allied with one another in a surrealistic version of Einstein's dream until neither is what it was or seems, evading even their own names. Pretty slick in a way, if you just skim over the surface of his elegant prose without stopping repeatedly to process one of his references to some text that is not his. The beautiful and burdensome bane of both philosophical discourse, let me show you I know it all, from Heraclitus to Harman, and of post and now post-postmodernism generally. But also pretty sticky, given the medium that serves as his conveyance. Materially, there is this book, his book, that artifactual antique of the print culture that indemnifies intellectual work against both dismissal and fundamental innovation, a hyperobject of vast proportions masquerading as something I can hold in my hands. And intellectually, by the sort of monstrosity of sequence that Dr. Rose Daniel finds intolerable in his search for meaning. In this case, the always default position of the philosopher in Western culture, the beginning to now narrative of dialectically impelled progress that emerges from the sediment of citations along the way, each new work purporting to be both continuous and discontinuous from that story, its temporary capstone, if you will. At the risk of sounding glib, one of the simplest imperatives I read in O-O-O is that it's not about me now. The underlying tenet for the two primary identity roles I created as an adult because of personal choices I made to become a teacher first, and then a father, each of which turns on a massive, blinding, Times Square-type light scroll with that sentence repeating over and over. I knew I could respect that imperative or not, but either way it was just true. And it was not rendered, crucially, as a provisional statement, as in, it's not about me any longer, which is how I was first tempted to read it. It was, in fact, as Morton makes clear, never about me. Not now, not before, not ever. OOO simply invites me to expand that imperative to larger and larger levels until I understand and accept that this about-me-ness is the foundational delusion of cultural privilege that animated the Western history portion of the Anthropocene, with all of its excesses, arrogances, and devastations on all the other alleged not-me's out there. The medium is the message, the extensions of man, both as a book and as a concept, is Marshall McLuhan's manifesto for radically reorienting our way of thinking about how we communicate with and relate to one another. Now that the hegemony of print has been undermined, if not deposed, by the cascade of audiovisual alternatives that emerged during the first half of the 20th century. Since McLuhan came of age during this moment, his own formation was vexed by these cross-currents of information, shaped intimately under the aegis of those new ways of making meaning, yet still regimented foundationally by the print-based culture of the academy. The fact that he renders what he has to say in a book the most conservative and stolid index toward the latter puts him at odds with his argument materially in ways that certainly inflect its pertinence. But what, in fact, does he hope to get across by assembling his two key terms in this order, that all-important is asserting a directional identity between them? Is the key element the order, or is it the absence of a not in that phrase? And is any of this still relevant? McLuhan's assertion that media are not vehicles of conveyances but extensions of embodiment seems so obvious now that Elon Musk is implanting microchips in human brains, Apple is selling goggles that turn us into walking Google, and ChatGPT is capable of doing so much of the pre-thinking we need to do to think that it's easy to believe we barely need to think at all. His primary obsession early on is with electricity, his equivalent of Morton's global warming, the force that feeds all the then-new media that interest him, one that jumpstarts, ironically, an evolutionary reversion to the sort of oral, tactile culture that predated the printing press, where simultaneity replaces sequence as the order of the moment, introducing a lag between habit and possibility. McLuhan seems to believe that we were right then on the cusp of a fundamental shift in how subjects, as in domains of knowledge, not people, might be arrayed in K-12 settings, moving away from the mechanical model founded on the industrial economy, where the parts were discrete entities with no essential interrelationships, and toward a more synergistic model where learning, he says, will be experimental, serendipitous, discovery-oriented, fundamentally creative, a humanities-based approach that will produce artists capable of presenting, not representing, synesthetic experience, promoting even more rapid adaptation to new media. He was clearly wrong, at least as far as schools go. A seventh grader these days still tramps from one room to another, math here, English there, art around the corner, without any systemic structure for perceiving them as facets of an organic human experience rather than slots of knowledge. Like separate silos full of corn and wheat and oats on a giant farm. And while university students experience their array of choices via electronic rather than hard copy catalogs now, they are still coded as a series of discrete fields of study. Like Aristotle's bookshelf, each subject between its own covers, all the titles facing outward for selection, no book ever able to bleed sidewise into the one it is sitting next to, let alone into all the others. The this is this, and that is not this, and this is not that approach to knowledge and learning that makes it difficult for any of us, students, teachers, professionals, everyone, to bleed into one another in some collaborative way toward common understandings. The radical transformation McLuhan seemed to believe was right around the corner, Morton seems to imply we are still awaiting. As the future rushes in, premeditating each present moment rather than unpremeditating time so we can find a path forward from where we happen to be now, and now, and now. Those empty sequences, both Morton, the various kinds of resistance to incremental change, cynicism, rage, wishful thinking at all, that afflict left, right, middle, especially in relation to global warming, and McLuhan, the way media indenture vast and entirely unreflective audiences to banal entertainment and chronic distraction rather than to education and activism angst about. And at the foundation of it all, for some reason, remains the book. That this radical disconnect between cultural imperatives and institutional adaptation has not been catastrophic is due in large part, I think, to the fact that young minds instinctively learn what the media of their moment makes possible via an on-the-fly autodidacticism, making them more expert with the technology at hand than those who purport to teach them how best to use it. McLuhan, for example, writes more compellingly about radio as a form of social currency, his own coming-of-age medium, than he does about TV, which he would have first encountered as an adult. In the former case, he seems to have what Morton would call an intimate connection with his object. In the latter case, he sounds more like I would if I tried to write with authority about rap music or TikTok. Someone of my vintage might find what I had to say interesting. Someone who grew up with those media would find it comical. I grew up with TV, and I find most of what McLuhan has to say about that medium more weird than wise. Window number 4. February 5th, 2024. Prelude. I wrote this section just after I wrote window number 1 above as a way of getting to the point. I place it out of calendric sequence as I have the other sections because I think it makes more sense that way, not just for you, my reader, but somehow also for me. It was McLuhan's chapter on radio and Morton's chapter on hypocrisies, both very late in their respective books, that oriented their key terms retroactively and clarified the implications of their arguments, at least for me. Okay, I've had my fun looking at these two books from the other side of Alice's looking glass, my language mirroring Morton's and McLuhan's, who, though separated by two generations during which postmodernism came and went, my adult life seemed to me to share the same DNA. One riding over white water, the other gliding over black ice, same medium, different message, or vice versa, depending on which point in the temporal range one is stepping back into from behind that glass. I need now to do some actual work. First, to try to understand for myself what new things McLuhan was trying to say about the relationship between media and messages in 1964. And then, what new things about objects Morton wants to call my attention toward in 2013 via hyperobjects. And maybe to get to a point that is not just more and more words about words, to rise up to a level where I can actually see McLuhan's media as Morton's hyperobjects and Morton's hyperobjects as McLuhan's media, both of which I'm quite sure, though quite sure is not a state of mind I experience with any confidence as it pertains to these books and those problems, would be considered anathema by their respective creators. So let me begin at the beginning, a title of mine, which I hope I can persuade you is something more than just a cutesy merger of their respective memes. In 1964, the media that McLuhan was primarily concerned with would be considered quite primitive by our standards. He talks a lot about TV, for example, and radio, and movies, none of which provides the possibility for interactivity, a feedback loop, all of which simply ferry their cargo directly to those who witness them. I sit and watch or listen, absently present, an image or sound wave making an impression on me with, perhaps, dramatic effects on my social and psychological matrices I am largely unconscious of. End of story, at least in the relatively simple realm of the mid-20th century media economy. What McLuhan says, first of all, is that all these media's messages are themselves other media, each disturbing the long-entrenched sequential linearity that print literacy induced technologically, which promoted individualism over kinship as the foundational social imperative. And, more mechanically, the sequential arrangement of all sorts of intellectual and economic structures along the lines of movable type, the foundational difference between imperial and indigenous cultures, a distinction he makes via the term civilization. At least some of the media that emerged via electricity reverted quite suddenly by evolutionary standards to those prior modes. One example of this is the movie, he says, wherein we return to the inclusive form of the icon. To explain this, he turns, oddly to me, to a seemingly static medium, painting. It was at this moment of the movie that cubism occurred. Cubism substitutes all facets of an object simultaneously for the point of view or facet of perspective illusion. Instead of a specialized illusion of the third dimension on canvas, cubism sets up an interplay of planes and contradiction, or dramatic conflict of patterns, lights, textures that drives home the message by involvement. Cubism, by seizing on instant total awareness, that is, sensory awareness of the whole, suddenly announced that the medium is the message, which is the moment that sequence yields to the simultaneous, and specialized segments of attention have shifted to total field. Before the electric speed and total field, it was not obvious that the medium is the message. The message, it seemed, was the content, as people used to ask what a painting was about. Yes, the moment that sequence yields to the simultaneous, its monstrosity finally overcome. And finally, late in the book, in Radio, the Tribal Dream, his coming-of-age medium, he seems to me to come clean and says, tradition, in a word, is the sense of the total past as now. Its awakening is a natural result of radio impact on electric information in general. Radio is provided with its cloak of invisibility like any other medium. It comes to us ostensibly with person-to-person directness that is private and intimate, while in more urgent fact, it is really a subliminal echo chamber of magical power to touch remote and forgotten chords. All technological extensions of ourselves must be numb and subliminal, else we could not endure the leverage exerted upon us by such extensions. Here, the storehouse of cultural information implied by Eliot's concept of tradition, that bedrock of modernism, one that can only be acquired via Herculean feats of bibliophilic labor, becomes, in McLuhan's late modernist moment, instantly available in theory and impossible to fully process in practice, via electricity, which short-circuits the sequencing of words into the simultaneity of sensation. He says, "Radio affects most people intimately, person to person, offering a world of unspoken communication between writer, speaker, and listener. This is the immediate aspect of radio, a private experience. The subliminal depths of radio are charged with the resonating echoes of tribal horns and antique drums. This is inherent in the very nature of the medium, with its power to turn the psyche and society into a single echo chamber." And further, he says, "Radio certainly contracts the world to village size and creates insatiable village tastes for gossip, rumor, and personal malice. But while radio contracts the world to village dimensions, it hasn't the effect of homogenizing the village quarters. Quite the contrary. Radio is not only a mighty awakener of archaic memories, forces, and animosities, but a decentralizing, pluralistic force, as is really the case with all electric power and media." Morton achieves much the same effect late in his book, especially in the chapter called Hypocrisies. He says, "The Aeolian properties of objects are well accounted for in 000. 000 holds that there are real things, and that those real things are objects, every single one. We humans are objects. The thing called a subject is an object. Sentient beings are objects. There are all kinds of objects that so-called subjects don't apprehend. Global warming existed long before human instruments started to detect it. For millions of years, oil oozed around deep under the ocean. All kinds of objects apprehended it, of course. When we are conscious of something, we are on a continuum with rock strata and plankton that apprehend oil in their own way." Here is sort of eerie wind-played music that emanates from objects, including even subjects as object, both delineates them as distinct things and invites us into a continuum with all of them. Like McLuhan's subliminal echo chamber with magical powers to touch remote and forgotten chords. Again, simultaneity overrides sequence, language succumbing to sensation. And further, he says, "According to 000, objects have a very interesting property. We only see their sensual qualities, interactions that spontaneously spawn new objects. Me smelling an oil spill is a whole new object in the universe. This object has special properties. What are they? Just like all objects, hyper-objects withdraw." Finally, hyper-objects, like all objects, withdraw. This may not make hyper-objects analogous with McLuhan's All technological extensions of ourselves must be numb and subliminal, else we could not endure the leverage exerted upon us by such extensions. But it sounds to me like it's in the same neural ballpark.